This week on Trek, Marry, Kill.
Seven, singing, sex.
Next.
Once, she was part machine, part human.
To all that makes us unique.
But Wednesday, on an all-new Voyager, Seven of Nine is about to become all woman.
You look beautiful.
Thank you.
Experience her first lesson in love.
You mean procreation?
One step at a time.
Because the time has come for Seven of Nine's first date.
Now are the list of two crewmen.
But wait until you find out which crew member will be her first lover.
Who'd she pick?
Voyager.
Trek, marry, kill.
Hi, I'm Brian.
Hi, I'm Kristen.
Welcome to Trek, marry, kill, a Star Trek podcast designed to facilitate the sonic interface with Borg transponders. As we continue to look at the big swings in Star Trek history, I've discovered that this month includes a sub-theme of love and technology. Last week, Captain Kirk used a universal translator to discover that a cloud of electricity was in love with Zefram Cochran. And the week before that, the Enterprise crew's emotions propelled them into a distant galaxy. It, like, supercharged the warp drive. This week, Seven of Nine is horny, and she decides that a hologram should help her find a guy. So love and technology, that makes sense, right? As, like, a sub-theme? All right. Someone to watch over... Wait, hold on. You barely talked.
Sorry.
It's very hot in LA.
Yeah, it's very warm. I just completed my second of two workouts of the day.
All right, so
I am like, I think I may have wasted all the energy on that. But I would argue that I don't think Seven of Nine is all that horny. But she's certainly curious.
Then let's just dive right into that. I think this was the 90s version of what they could... You know, a woman having a sexuality? What? I mean, this is, they can't say it for some reason, but that's what's going on here, yeah. Isn't it? All right, yeah. Someone to watch over me. Yeah.
She's curious as to what romance, sex, and love is.
That's right. And she's being a voyeur around the Voyager.
And instead of just looking at weird internet porn, she stalks her shipmates and colleagues.
Possibly inspired by the movie Sliver. We don't know.
I did not see that, but
Sliver was an erotic thriller from the 90s.
Remember with, those?
One of the Baldwins, and I can't remember which one after Alec. The one that everyone actually really liked along with Alec simultaneously is it's
Steven?
Steven or
is it Daniel?
No. Who's the right winger now? Isn't that Steven? Is it Billy Baldwin?
Billy. I thought it was Billy.
Okay. Anyway, so maybe it's Stephen. Anyway, so he was the star of Sliver, and he basically like had video cameras installed in every room in this high rise and watched what everyone was doing. And then I guess maybe is responsible for murders and, you know, Sharon Stone's his next target. I'm kind of just remembering the trailers. I never saw the movie. So,
yeah, there used to be a whole genre of film called erotic thrillers.
That's right. And some people want to bring it back.
I could go for an erotic thriller.
Like, yeah.
I don't know who the hell they'd get in it, though.
That's true.
Like, who's going to, you know.
Florence Pugh could probably do an erotic thriller.
I did see Poor Things, and if they convinced Emma Stone to do that.
Convince her? She produced it.
Well, someone convinced somebody that this was a good movie.
I think there is an honest thing that we've all forgotten, that movies give you immortality, or at least the potential to survive beyond your lifespan. And so, like, I think of Jennifer Beals in Flashdance is my number one now, of like, that will exist forever, the way that this human being looked.
Yeah, that's not even her dancing, I thought.
It doesn't matter. It's just like when the way she looks in the movie is like one of the most beautiful human beings to ever exist on film, preserved forever. That there is some version like Jennifer Lawrence in No Hard Feelings. Like that was a turn for her. She's very funny in it, but she's also like willing to show her body off and throw it around. I'm like, there is a version of like, I'm preserving for all time. Like Chris Hemsworth, like I am hot as fuck for all time. Let it be known. And I don't know. I just think that's wonderful. If you can do it, why not?
Yeah. better them than me, I guess.
Sharon Stone's got Total Recall and Basic Instinct. You know what I mean? Like, she's just she's set up.
although when I'm like old, I'll probably be very upset that I didn't like take more nudes or something.
Yeah, more tasteful nudes. Maybe that's what the American culture needs.
I didn't say they were tasteful, but I didn't bother. I didn't bother cleaning the mirror first. No, I'm kidding.
There's a distinct lack of tasteful nudes in this one, but plenty of Jeri Ryan being preserved for all time in Someone to Watch Over Me. The 22nd
line is amazing. I couldn't stop thinking about it.
Wearing a rib cage vest that caused physical damage to her ribs.
I know.
So, you know, pluses and minuses, I guess. Someone to Watch Over Me is the 22nd episode of Star Trek Voyager's fifth season. It's the 25th anniversary of this episode. Holy shit, man. Wow. Seriously. I mean, we're not bros, we're friends, but I'm calling you, bro, we're dying. We're going to die someday. 25 years? I can't believe this episode is 25 years old.
Yeah.
April 28th.
I was like 1 year old when this.
Yes. Listen, we are so far apart in age, but I'm, as someone who's many years ahead of you, I'm telling you, the light at the end of the tunnel is a train. We're it's going to hit us both.
By the way, so me lying about my age is a running joke with my friends since I was, I want to say like 17.
Oh, they were saying since you were 12.
No, like because I was like, if you lie early about it, then there's no, like, no one can dispute it. So, like, even my age when I signed up for, like, Facebook, it's wrong. And you can't change it. No.
So you were like, I skipped two grades.
No, it didn't matter. No,
didn't
care.
Matter. No.
Like, you're in college, people go, hey, oh, oh. How
April
are you?
Yeah. April 28th, 1999, a fact that does not depress me at all, that this is a 25-year-old episode.
By the way, you're not even that much older than me. Like, you make it seem like you're at least a decade older than me, but it's like a few years at best.
It's fun to do that because I think face-wise, you've got the skincare regime going down there. I'm holding my own for someone who just barely tosses water on it, but my grays are just out of control. My grays just lap you and you don't.
Yeah, well, I don't have any.
Yeah,
grays.
You don't have any grays.
Well, so have you tried? Like, did you try being a natural blonde?
No, and I would have hated it if I had been. So.
Oh, yeah. You would have looked at yourself in the mirror every morning and been like,
self-loathing. Yeah. Stupid yellow hair.
God, I can't wait to dye my hair. Does anyone have a wig? You yeah, can dye your hair now, though, off. To get rid of the grays if that bothers you that much.
No. I'm just I see pictures of like pre-pandemic me with the same length of beard. And it's like, oh my God, like it was a completely black beard. And now it's just almost a completely gray beard. Well, doesn't it's wild.
I don't know if that's for sure, but does the beard go gray first?
What is
the first hair on the body to go gray?
The gray hairs did not start with the beard, but that's tricky because I wasn't going full beard when I started noticing grays. But the beard has shot far ahead of the scalp hair was staying pretty good, not gray, and the beard kept kind of going. I mean, yeah, the gray hairs they start popping up, and it was like, that's weird. Anyway.
Are they supposed to start in the temples first? Oh no.
I think they do, yeah. They do.
Okay, well then
I was
still
okay with that because they were, you know, my hair is pretty dark and
yeah,
you know, it was
Brian,
it
you still have
pretty well.
A yeah. lot of hair.
Yeah, no. I'm not saying balding, I was just saying gray. I can't believe it. That's all. That's
I
all
think
I'm saying.
Many, yes. many men would be like, I will take full head of hair and gray.
I'm very appreciative of that. I noticed the recession. I have definitely documented the recession being like that's receded half a centimeter. I've noticed it. Anyway, 1999. This episode aired like around the time I was getting ready to graduate high school. Mm-hmm. So I don't know where I was mentally, emotionally, but I was definitely like,
well, you know what's going on in 1999, everybody.
Y2K.
And there was a bit on Conan O'Brien year 2000. And they kept it going for what? Like, at almost got to be like at least a decade past Y2K.
Oh, yeah. They kept doing it in the TBS era, too. It's great.
Just like, what differences will there be in the year 2000? And it's a very good bit. And I'm sure there's tons of it on YouTube. But if you haven't checked it out.
The joke I remember the most is this one. Aunt Jemima and Mrs. Butterworth will shock the world when they announce that they've tasted each other's syrup.
And for those who have not seen it, it's a guy with a flashlight under his chin.
Oh, yeah.
Like, everyone just has a flashlight under their chin.
I don't know if I could actually see it.
That's a special effect. Yeah. I can't do it because it's too high.
Yeah. So I was definitely Star Trek was in the childish things bin. If we were talking like a story, Toy Story thing, I'm thinking about, all right, I've got, you know, college situated. Let's see what we can do about this virginity problem. You know, there's definitely things going on in 1999 that I'm thinking about here.
You and Seventh.
That's right.
At the same time.
So on that level, I could relate.
You're like, wow.
If another 10 is struggling too, then
so relatable.
Yes. Teleplay by Michael Taylor from a story by Brandon Braga, directed by Tom Paris himself, Robert Duncan McNeil.
That's shocking though, because he's in it a lot.
He's in it.
They don't put themselves in it too much.
Yeah that's
hard.
True. That's true.
So good for you, Tom Paris.
I don't think this was his first episode, though, directing the show. So that's another reason why. Yeah. Let's see. Memory Alpha describes it. The Doctor teaches Seven about dating and romantic relationships, but then realizes that he may have developed feelings for her himself. What Memory Alpha doesn't mention is the B plot of this one, wherein Voyager is hosting an ambassador played by Scott Thompson from The Kids in the Hall.
Who is... fantastic.
Yes. And they are a very monk-like religious culture. And the moment he gets on board and his boss leaves, he's like, all right, time to eat sugar.
Mm-hmm. And spice.
Yes,
spicy.
Exactly. It's a nice emotional counterpoint to Seven's story in that, you know, he's just throwing himself into it, right? And Seven's mm-hmm. like trying to, like a young, like a fawn trying to get on her feet and all that stuff. But it doesn't quite pay off, but it's there.
Seven is doing it much more clinically. And
that's right.
This guy is
scientifically,
just
yeah.
going. He's on shore leave, basically.
Yes, exactly. The episode is really only made possible because Mom and Dad, Janeway and Tuvok, are off the ship.
Yeah, I you know what? I've noticed that. That was... bingo.
You know, the kids get up to no good. This episode is basically My Fair Lady, which I've never seen.
I cannot believe that.
That I've never seen.
That is
My
shocking
Fair Lady.
To me.
I have seen She's All That, which is okay. Basically My Fair Lady.
It is My Fair Lady.
Yeah. And I've seen WALL-E, which references My Fair Lady.
Okay.
But that's it. And I know who Barbara Streisand is. So.
Well, Barbara Streisand is not in My Fair Lady.
Oh, who is in My Fair Lady?
The film is Audrey Hepburn, but on Broadway, it was Julie Andrews, and they gave the part to Audrey Hepburn instead of Julie Andrews, which was a big kind of like it was not received well at the time in like the theater or film community. And Julie Andrews can actually sing, and so they had a dub of Audrey Hepburn's lines.
Is it because Audrey Hepburn opens and Julie Andrews had not yet?
Well, Audrey Hepburn was a big star.
Right. That's what I'm saying.
Big film star, and Julie Andrews was just in theater. But then the Academy gave Julie Andrews an Oscar for Mary Poppins, of all things, as sort of a sorry about that.
I mean, Mary Poppins is a great movie and she's great.
It's a great movie and she's great in it, but it's kind of a weird role to have won. Best actress.
Yeah.
Like, are there any other Disney movies where someone won best actress?
Well, I mean, she is playing a character who's practically perfect in every way.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, she nails it, but.
And I have not seen My Favorite Year, which I guess is kind of the inspiration for the Scott Thompson Neelix storyline.
Really?
Which, yeah.
I have seen My Favorite Year, and I, okay, all right.
Yeah, I'm just going. Do you remember the first time you saw this episode, or is Trek Mary Kill?
I don't think I ever saw it before this. No.
I remember very much, like I said, I'm 1 foot out the door from being like a diehard Star Trek, that's my life fan. I'm like, what's next? my own life I have to like really take hold of here. And this was one where I was like, oh, like, all right, I got some Star Trek juice still. I'm still interested in what they can do. They can still surprise me. Because Voyager by this point was, you know, it was like a TNG remix in a lot of ways. And even though bringing Seven of Nine in was an unmistakably great thing, it was still like, you know, they were still prone to falling into like, I've seen that, or technobabble being the solution to every problem, teching the tech and all that stuff. And here's one where they didn't do that. Had nothing to do with science fiction stuff. So I want to talk about this real quick. I almost put it for most of its time, but this is how much I actually wanted to mention it now. Scott Thompson, I really have thought about this, and I'm pretty sure because I was watching Kids in the Hall when it was not like when it was on after Saturday Night Live, like it would be rerun. So I didn't watch it like first run, but I was still like 9 or 10 or something. I'm pretty sure his Buddy Cole segments were my entryway into gay people. Gay culture, really? Certainly, but like just the idea, like understanding, it was just not something that was a topic that came up hardly at
like
all.
You
guys, so,
like your family didn't have any like gay friends. Or
exactly.
Anything?
There, it just was not in, it was not around. So I think that, so, you know, those were always like, what is this? And like, oh, this is cool. And he was also very funny. They all are very funny. So, you know.
Yeah. And for those who don't know, The Kids in the Hall was a sketch comedy show. But it had a lot of gay cast or queer cast members.
Well, I mean, Canadian comedy troupe Lorne Michaels produced their show, or at least helped bring it over stateside. No, he lent his name to it. Now I remember. Yeah. And anyway, so, you know, it's a big deal. They did an Amazon revival season recently. They had a documentary about him. If you have no idea who we're talking about, you've definitely, listener, have seen every member of the Kids in the Hall in something over the years that wasn't Kids in the Hall. They're all funny guys. Dave Foley was the star of News Radio, a personal favorite sitcom of mine, which ran a long time, but, you know, I think is probably now basically cult status, even though it had freaking Phil Hartman in it, but it's all very 90s. Anyway, do you think holograms are people and should have the attending rights of an individual?
No.
Me neither.
Do you know how I think I'm coming up with that? Because they aren't.
Do I think one that's been programmed as, you know, complex with the as much complexity as the Doctor should not be treated with some sort of like conversational respect in the moment? No, I think why not? That's what the interface is designed to do, like to relax you, the patient that's interacting with him. So there's no, and he's able to converse like a person, but yeah, it's bizarre. I mean, I like that Voyager pushes in that direction. This episode isn't like really one of the signposts along the Doctor's individuality here, but I actually really like that he's jumping into the story. He's the one that wants to guide Seven of Nine through this entire thing without any thought of like, well, I'm only a hologram. Like, you know what I mean? Like, he's approaching it like a person would. And I don't know, I kind of like that, but the show does ask you from time to time to remember that he's a hologram, and you have to kind of land on how you feel about that for the stories to work.
Yeah.
And I don't know when we're going to do another hologram Doctor episode yet. So I figured, why not ask a question now? Do you think it would be this difficult for Seven of Nine to find some dick?
No.
Yeah. It's
especially on a ship where everyone's been marooned together for years.
Yeah, I mean, I've mentioned this when
would it be hard for her to find some dick that she wants? Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. But I mean, that's what the holodeck's for, right? Mm-hmm. That the implication at the end of this one, because spoiler, she's like, okay, I tried dating. It's not for me. Oh, well, moving on. The implication is like, I'm going to, when I need to really get my grind on, I'm going to the holodeck and I'll figure it out. Or Unimatrix Zero. I'll like just go to the Borg Dreamland and have some fun there. Some specific thoughts. Jerry Ryan told Cinefantastique at the time, even the editors were coming up to me on the set and saying, this never happens, but everyone was coming in and out of the other editing room and stopping what they were doing and watching the show while we were cutting it together. They said it was just so charming that everybody loved it. I actually also think that the editors would use any excuse to go up to Jerry Ryan. So Jerry Ryan and Robert Picardo did, quote, at least some of, unquote, their own singing in this episode. That's right. This is a pre-Subspace Rhapsody partial musical episode of Star Trek. So,
yeah.
Filming began without without a finished script. Unusual for television, perhaps. Robert Duncan McNeil told Cinefantastique in the same issue, we were just sort of making it up, shooting it as it was being written. It definitely kept us on our toes, kept us aware of how much we were telling, in what order we were telling the story, and not to have the Doctor fall in love with Seven in Act One to really find the whole journey and fill it out fully. Robert Picardo offered, this episode is like the movie Casablanca because we shot it without knowing what the end would be. It's like shooting a romantic story without knowing the payoff. But Casablanca turned out pretty well. I'm hoping that we will be equally fortunate. Slow down, Bogart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I have seen that.
Okay, good.
I've seen Casablanca, which is one of the greatest movies ever made. So there we go.
We talked about it several times on this show, in fact, about how you should watch it if you haven't seen it already. But be prepared because it will seem like a cliche. But this is where it all began.
This is the Citizen Kane problem. This is why I have not actually watched Citizen Kane.
Well, Citizen Kane is boring.
Okay, but also it's been, every part of it has been recycled in pop culture that I have to like be in a mood.
Way you should watch Citizen Kane is like with one of those Roger Ebert commentary tracks. Because it's interesting to have someone point out to you all the good filmmaking.
Are you trying to suggest that Orson Welles is not a fantastic filmmaker?
Yes, he is. Wow. But I'm saying I find that it's not an enjoyable movie to watch. Just sit down and watch it.
But Casablanca.
Like, it's not like, Casablanca is different.
That's a movie. I'm going to take a moment every time it's referenced to say one of the greatest movies ever made. Mm-hmm. Just like I'm going to say this. The B plot of Someone to Watch Over Me vaguely resembles the Star Trek The Next Generation episode Liaisons. One of the worst episodes of Star Trek, probably maybe the worst episode of TNG, which is saying a lot. I hate that episode and I'll take every chance I get to rip on it. It sucks. Anyway, in Liaisons, some Iarian ambassadors visit the Enterprise D for a cultural exchange. And then one of the ambassadors gets obsessed with studying pleasure and all that stuff. So, you know, obviously they're like, well, no one remembers that episode or wants to remember it. Let's just recycle that here and get a better actor and do that. And that's what they kind of did there.
Before we move on, since you haven't seen My Fair Lady, and for anyone else who hasn't seen it, My Fair Lady it's a good story, but it's if you realize it's about a misogynistic asshole. So when people try to recycle that story and don't put or like it's not as overt about it being misogynistic, I kind of side eye it a bit.
So, I mean, should we talk about that now? Because I don't think this episode
would
avoid.
I have it under Trek tropes.
Yeah,
get into it more later.
Yeah. But speaking of My Fair Lady, because that's a musical, right? There's dancing as well. Yeah. Just like in this one, there's singing and dancing.
A little bit more, you know, it was Lerner and Lowe who did it, but not. I'm gonna sing
well,
You Are My Sunshine.
The dance sequences here were choreographed by Laura Feder Bear, the wife of Star Trek Deep Space Nine writer Iris Stephen Bear. So
Go.
Let's get into the grades. Great scenes. Why don't you lead us off, Kristen?
So at the very beginning, Seven of Nine dictating B'Elanna's sex life and mentioning that, well, everyone knows when you're doing it.
No one on Deck Nine, Section 12.
Yeah. Who doesn't know when you're engaged in intercourse or whatever nomenclature she used.
B'Elanna Torres threatening to break Seven of Nine's nose.
Yeah. I was like, oh, this is going to get interesting.
That scene is only great because of the two women. The mm-hmm. Neelix and Paris are like, you guys just suck. So they're so boring. But I also thought they pulled, I agree with you. That was my first great scene. But I also think they pulled the punch where they had Torres walk away instead of her having to be restrained. You know what I mean? Like she talks a big talk and then it just kind of goes to, goes to the credits kind of softly. But
so when the doctor is like, I'm going to teach you about courtship. He just gives her like a PowerPoint presentation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very funny to me.
Oh, like, yeah. He calls it Love Amid the Stars.
Mm-hmm.
The Milky Way galaxy, home to thousands, or he goes, the Milky Way, home to thousands of humanoid species and countless courtship rituals. Yeah, that's great.
And then they do a role-playing exercise on the holodeck.
Yeah.
Where they're reading from a script. It's very funny. Do you come here often?
Yes. I do like when good actors have to pretend that their characters are bad actors. That was funny. And then also Tom Paris comes in and he gets under the doctor's skin enough where they make the bet that the doctor can make Seven of Nine a respectable woman who's good at dating in a certain amount of time.
Yeah. Tom Paris is a bad Colonel Pickering, by the way. That's the character he's supposed to be.
Got it. Well, I mean,
by the way, the place that the holodeck set, it looks a little bit like the Tam O'Shanter restaurant on Los Feliz. If you have been there. Old favorite place of Walt Disney.
Oh, okay.
They had a little booth for him when his studio was down the street and on Hyperion.
I was not aware of that.
Yeah.
I like the scene right before that too, though, where the doctor asks she was studying Tom and B'Elanna and discovers that she's curious about dating. And then he does worm his way into this exploration of her sexuality. But I still like the scene because I don't know if there's anyone that you can kind of talk in a way that's maybe not how most people talk. It's you can talk to Seven of Nine that way where you can be very direct. Her boundaries are much more different. She's less private about certain things than other people are. And like the doctor is her doctor. So like they're already talking about certain things. So I thought that was the only way to really get into the story, basically.
Yeah. You know? Otherwise, it's like, what's happening here?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he is kind of doing that. But it's a nice marriage of both of them being curious about, either each other or certain things that are new to them. Scott Thompson doesn't want to leave the mess to see the rest of the ship or do his ritualistic prayers. He wants to stay and eat dessert.
Yeah.
just him
is plowing through every dessert and spicy food and drink.
Neelix is just flabbergasted.
Yeah, I've never seen someone put, he's never seen anyone put away that much food, which is, come on. So not necessarily a good, a great scene, but it did make me laugh. So when she finally gets a date with What's-His-Face, she asks him out. Then when they get to the Tam O'Shanter, the size of the fucking lobsters they get.
Cartoons.
It is. Like, there's no such thing.
Even Lower Decks would be like, no, that's too big.
I assume it's dead now, but there's a little aquarium.
The lobster? Yes. Probably dead.
I'm going to tell a story.
Okay.
There's a little aquarium in Dana Point where I lived for a long time. And in little aquarium is a giant fucking lobster that they're like, we think it's like 60 years old, but we don't know for sure. And it was almost the size of that giant lobster that they knew for sure was old as hell and could not be eaten even if you wanted to. And looked, spotted and gross. Like it is. Yes, lobsters can get that big. But you should not eat them if they do, because they're old as hell.
Wait, it was in the tank with the other lobsters, or was that?
It was an aquarium. It wasn't a restaurant.
Okay, all right.
I was like, oh, I want him. No, it was just like one of the things they had in like where the starfish were or something or
got
whatever.
Got it. I've never actually seen lobsters or crabs. No, it's not true. I've seen crabs on the beach. Never mind. Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting. I like the scene before the date where we discover Seven has perfect pitch, and then they sing "You Are My Sunshine," and and the doctor, we see the doctor kind of falling for her. It shouldn't work, and so, you know, but goddamn, when Star Trek decides to commit to something goofy, nobody does it better. Like, it's what Star Trek's strength is. Come on, Harry Kim goes to Seven of Nine and discovers that she's working on her list of potential dating partners, and she's looking for someone who has like musical ability. And he goes, "Well, I play the clarinet," and she,
"Yeah,
so you're not on the list."
Sorry. <Come on.
laughs> And then he swallows his pride, and he still kind of like steers her in a direction. And then the way when she settles on the guy she picks for the date. I love the way Jerry Ryan delivers the line. She goes, "We worked on an away mission. He seemed efficient," but like not in a robotic way. She's like actually very touched, or like it's like,
yeah,
it affects her. It was great.
He was the least incompetent.
That's right.
Man,
that's
I right. had worked with that day. And so therefore he
no,
might
she's
be,
like,
you know what I mean? Like, I know. Yeah. Like that's how it was.
She's like, everyone in the ship lets me down constantly. And that time that guy did not. But I actually like Garrett Wong adjusting his performance, because listen, we all love Jonathan Frakes, but you know, Riker in the day, he had basically two switches of acting. And so he's either cranky or he's horny. That's how Jonathan Frakes would perform. And that's kind of like a lot of the Star Trek actors, they have two dials. So the ones where they have to go from like being kind of like surface nice to then actually just being like an actual friend. Like watching Harry Kim do that and Garrett Wong conveying that. I don't know. I appreciated that. I thought the scene worked, but also just like, I can't believe that scene's in there. How embarrassing for the actor.
You are not on the list. Sorry. Yeah. And I also have Scott Thompson's character at the Tam O'Shanter bar with his shirt open, surrounded by holodeck alien ladies.
Yeah.
Drunk as shit.
It's fantastic. Basically, all of his scenes are great scenes, I think. But I mean, the doctor asks Seven to let her hair down and shake it out. It's so dumb.
Yeah, it's so dumb. I talk about that later.
I still put it in as like, I can't believe they're doing this scene. But guess what? They're not doing, Kristen. They're not doing a scene where someone has to generate an interferometric pulse from the damaged deflector dish. So instead, they're doing this cliched scene, and watching it in Star Trek, I'm like, that's fine. It's Jerry Ryan's hair coming down. She's a very beautiful woman. I mean,
yeah,
it's fine, but it's also so dumb.
The part about My Fair Lady is it's a street gutter rat girl with no class who literally has dirt on her face and can't speak well. But now it's like, oh yes, this I can really help Jerry Ryan get a date. Like, this is not difficult.
She's like she's the Borg version of Cameron Diaz's, you know,
like I was thinking maybe Tom Paris has a gambling problem or something. This is not a very good thing to bet on.
Yeah, but in the date scene, not only does she not know how to eat a lobster, but like they're just playing the hits of like every cliche of a bad date. She tears his rotator cuff when they try to dance.
Yeah. Also, like, if just those two things, yes, the rotator cuff, that sucks, but that can easily be fixed.
Yes.
That would not put you off from dating
That would have been funny if the doctor's like, I better get you to sick bay, and the guy is so wanting to have sex with Seven
and Nine. He's like, I'm good.
But that, I mean, we'll talk about that in most of its time, but like, that's really what the episode maybe more realistically would have been. But, and then I think the last scene where Seven gives him the adjusted tricorder and says, thanks for the memories. And the doctor is not able to confess his feelings as real as they are, to Seven of Nine. And she's like, the barn doors are shut. I'm not going to pursue this, and I'm good, and thanks for trying to help me out. If I ever need advice, I'll come back to you again. And you know, all the men who make Star Trek Voyager are like, it's so heartbreaking, and I'm like, Even at the time, I was like, not heartbreaking, but I was glad that they actually tried to tell a story that's based in emotions. It's very funny that they could only do that with the Borg character and the hologram.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I thought it was a great scene. Any other great scenes?
No.
Best Trek tropes.
When the doctor is giving the PowerPoint TED talk about dating, it says lesson one, first contact.
Mm.
Just anytime there's like a little first contact mentioned. So I thought it was cute.
An easy punchline and very charmingly delivered. Yes, very, very good. Harry Kim gets denied. I already mentioned that. Yeah. I just thought that was great.
Everyone's street clothes are just utterly ridiculous.
Oh, they're so
I put on her best because, you know, it's consistent. Like, it's funny to see. It's entertaining for me to see what they think streetwear is.
Yeah.
I think the only time I think it was actually good streetwear is when that the attorney from Strange New Worlds.
Uh-huh.
I forget her name now. But
oh, right. Yeah.
From, that, what's
you're saying the only trial? Time in Star Trek history was Una's attorney?
I was like, oh, this is what a stylish woman would wear. Like everyone else in the history of Star Trek is pretty much horribly dressed. I mean, maybe there's a few others.
You've thrown William Ware Tice's designs off a cliff. All those like, cutouts showing hips and no, you
I
just.
Mean, I mean, there was some actually, there were some interesting ones we've seen, but I wouldn't say they were stylish, right?
I would say they were more stylish than what we got from TNG on until Strange New Worlds.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
Learning about new cultures. I mean, this seems trite, but I really like the end, how the abbot, Scott Thompson's boss, tells him, oh, it's a shame you didn't try stuff out. Mm-hmm. I do actually like that Neelix is just so willing to lie to cover up what happened.
Yeah.
That's kind of cute and funny, but we said all those scenes are great. But I like the little turn there. It's not like it doesn't undermine the characters. They're like, well, you know, it's the whole reason why we're pious is because there's a path to stay on. But that doesn't mean like when you're in a new situation where there's a potential for new experiences that you shouldn't explore them. Just, you know, don't forget who you are. I don't know. I think, again, the two storylines kind of resonate there. But, you know, nice little Star Trek twist at the end.
I put Neelix being bad at his job. So he
as a best Trek trope.
Well, yeah.
No, I'm with you because he was so gung ho. He was like so into it. So enthusiastic.
Yeah. And then he like literally couldn't do any of it right. He let the guy get drunk. It turns out his body can't synthesize alcohol or something. Can't metabolize alcohol.
Yeah.
So he's going to be drunk forever.
Or they're just going to half assimilate him and let Seven's nanoprobes take care of
it.
Which is a ridiculous solution. But again, it's Star Trek Voyager. So what else is new? I love that Neelix has two modes, though. Enthusiastic and flabbergasted.
Mm-hmm.
That's all.
That's I can't wait to do this. Oh!
Don't you worry, Captain. Oh, bah, 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 bah.
Oh no. Yeah. Like it's... Like what? Like a Colonel Clink?
It's kind of he's just kind of the perfect morale officer,
the
though,
other
right?
One? The other not Colonel Clink, the other one.
Oh right,
I see nothing. That
yeah,
one.
That's right. He is the perfect morale officer, though, that with like things are good or bad. That's
yeah, he seems like a little too like high and low for me for like the morale officer, right? Like he should be a little bit more even keeled.
I mean, Talaxians have no chill. I can buy that. That makes sense.
So. I did put this in best, but maybe it should have been in worst. But like Janeway and Tuvok are off the ship, so like all hell breaks loose. Like nothing goes to plan. It's like they probably actually had work they were supposed to be doing, but then like the doctor's like, no, I'm gonna teach Seven how to date. And Seven was probably signed something, and Tom Paris is just like, other than banging B'Elanna, he's making side bets and what have you. Yeah.
Well, without like tipping what my ultimate grade's going to be, or maybe even yours, like we're saying that this story is both enjoyable and only possible because they're off the ship, right?
Yeah, it cannot be possible if either Janeway or Tuvok are on board because they'd be like, what are you doing? What are you guys doing?
So this has to be a best Trek trope only because we're like signaling so many positives.
Normally we're like, God, everyone on the ship is useless. But this time it makes for a good episode.
Yeah. I gotta say that the holodeck can be a best Trek trope, a worst Trek trope. When Star Trek Voyager, you know, the fact that they're marooned and they're so far from home, that the idea that this series has a lot of holodeck use and holodeck episodes makes perfect sense. But I really like the way it's used here, where the Doctor uses it to rehearse his confession to Seven of Nine, or his plan to reveal. I'm like, that seems like a perfectly normal use of the holodeck, to be honest.
Like, I need to play through these scenarios.
Yeah. So I thought that was a great use. Any other best Trek tropes?
No.
Worst Trek tropes. Tom Paris is a pig.
Yeah.
I didn't need this episode to know that, but this episode cements it.
Yeah. So like in My Fair Lady, Henry Higgins is the actual pig character and Colonel Pickering's pretty nice. But although he does help make the bet, but like he's much nicer to Eliza than Henry Higgins.
I don't know what B'Elanna sees in him. He's kind of dismissive of her feelings. He's trying to tell her to calm down and let's go get a nightcap.
It's not like she's spoiled for choice. Right?
Yeah, I guess that's true. He and the show, the tone of the show, to me, every time I dip back in and watch some Voyager, it feels like Voyager and Paris are more guilty of being like the Captain Kirk most people who never watched the original series perceive Captain Kirk to be.
Yeah.
And that's because they hate Shatner. But like the rest of the Voyager cast and are not, like, everyone likes Robert Duncan McNeil. He seems like a good guy too, actually. But like none of the rest of the cast are famous enough for anyone to care about them outside of Star Trek. So like Shatner is just like, he's had all this history and people hate him. His fellow actors hated him. Like, that's been with him from the very beginning. And so it's like easy for them to dismiss him. And then here, in the face of like clear evidence of like, Tom Paris doesn't seem like a good guy. Mm-hmm. He doesn't seem like the Doctor's constantly picking at his character. And then Tom Paris behaves in a way that supports people thinking low, like very little of him. He's always supporting that. And then, you know, it just seems like not a good guy. Also, I don't think holograms are people, but it is a little classless to be ripping off the Doctor's jokes and then making jokes about their holographic Doctor to the ambassador of this new culture. Seems a little gross. Not a fan.
I put open flames on the ship, because in the beginning at the mess hall, we have two candles. I'm like, I hate it. It's insane. You can't have open flames on a ship in space. You can't even have it on the water, and it's surrounded by water. Okay. And then I put, oh no, it's My Fair Lady.
You don't like when Star Trek does homages?
I don't like when almost anything tries to do My Fair Lady. I think, again, it's a misogynistic story. Like, there are, I would say still watch it because it's a good film and it's interesting. But like, the Henry Higgins character is horrible. And it's played to be horrible. But like, in almost every adaptation, it's like, oh no, he actually really liked her. It's, I don't know, it's not misogynistic. It's like, it's over the top misogyny. And it's supposed to be. But then like, it's always watered down. But it's still misogyny. And I don't know, it's not cartoonish enough to be pointed out that way, I guess. I don't know. It's hard for me to put it all into words.
I have my thoughts on that for the next grade for most of its time. I have one more worst Trek trope.
I have some too.
Let them.
The Doctor thinking Seven isn't already hot enough for her date, and like, oh, you better put something nice on. You better fix your hair.
Oh my god!
Ridiculous. Oh my god. Maybe not a Trek trope, but certainly a television trope.
Wait, I don't remember. Where did I put the note? Okay, so he reminds us that the Doctor designed her cat suit. And there was like a fake reason for why she has to look like that, because of like skin grafts and the Borg tech you had to pull off and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And they reveal in that he also toyed around or was designing other things, which seemed to have included normal clothes. So the worst Trek trope is like, justifying the grossness through like scientific mumbo jumbo.
Yeah, it's like the weird stupid. Like
yeah,
underwire bra built into the cat suit thing.
It just made more sense to make you look naked all the time, Seven.
It's so stupid. Oh my god.
Any others?
No.
All right. The total. Okay, this is a '90s Trek, worst Trek trope. But the total jobbers they get to play possible dates for Seven of Nine. just, you know, for the most part, because TNG, you know, that and DS9, they were syndicated, and so the budgets were very much lower. And then when Voyager became network, it seems like they put that money into paying Mulgrew, but also like visual effects. And to make it look like fit on network even better, or they had to pay network rates too. But it seems like since all the same casting people carried over, that they still operated under the just get someone we can get for scale.
Yeah.
and so they don't look, they look, you know, that is first though, I have to apologize to Brian McNamara. That's the human date that Seven has. His IMDb is 2 miles long. He's done series. He's not a bad looking guy. He's been working forever. All that stuff.
He seemed like familiar to me.
He's been in a bunch of stuff. He did Army Wives for like 5 seasons. Like, but before that, years and years.
Sure.
He is a very like he is a face. He is like the best they could get. But again, here's the problem. It's Jerry Ryan. So yeah, you've got to find someone who can get on her level of like. Camera presence. I know that they're trying to play the idea of like this guy actually gets nervous in these situations, but like even the first guy, the hologram that the doctor programmed for her,
yeah,
that guy looks like Jonathan from Buffy the Vampire Slayer, like this little twerp.
It's like at least like an 8. Give me that.
Oh, I'm so tired of it. It made me think of all the dudes over the years that Troy had, just like forgetless or forgettable, just like literal milk toast, just on the screen. So, such a worst Trek trope whenever they try to get someone that, you know, because the men who were approving the casting didn't want anyone that felt threatening to them. But yeah, it's just stupid.
What's this Paul Newman got that I don't got?
Again, all respect. Ryan McNamara, who is a good-looking guy and did great. I'm just saying, like,
yeah,
what were you?
Yeah, they're totally
it was an underwritten part. It was a tough part. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But like,
yeah,
yeah. Okay.
Most of his time quality
is Bolano's wig getting worse. I feel like it might be getting worse.
What sucks about Bolano, which is that I remember being like. Whenever I saw like press photos of Voyager when it would be Roxanne Biggs outside of her makeup, I'm like, why don't they just find a way that she's not a Klingon anymore?
Yeah. Like
she is a beautiful Klingon woman and it feels like they're
already bad.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because she's a principal player that'd get her something nice. I feel like right. Worf's wigs were better.
Or at least got better.
Yeah. Well, yeah. His wig was always better than like day player Klingon.
Yes.
Because those were wigs for him.
B'Elanna occasionally had okay hair.
But not this one.
Yeah.
It was like, it just seemed like they
no,
didn't.
No, no, I agree, not this one.
They didn't wash her wig out or something, or I don't know. They didn't have time to style it or what. I don't know. Neelix's apron?
Sure.
It's like something I would have made in like crafts. Girl Scout crafts. it sounds like the producers allowed the actors to sing in a recording booth rather than sing live to tape.
Smart.
Which some productions nowadays, I'm not going to name any names, don't do, which is a bad idea every single time. I don't care how talented the singers are. It doesn't sound good.
Well, we've often talked about how, you know, for some reason, Star Trek has so much looping. So it's like, to me, it's like the idea that they wouldn't do the recording booth would be like, was there a gas leak? What? So it makes perfect sense. That's a good choice. Criticizing women for not being married already. That like there's some old world shit in this episode. In that first scene where the doctor worms his way into her exploration of her own human sexuality, the tag on the scene is him saying most women start dating a little younger than you, but better late than never. Mm-hmm. And it was like, okay, real old woman shit or old world shit. Not nearly as cold as what the old world Japanese say to their women who aren't married after like 25. Have I already said this on the podcast?
No,
this is what getting old is. Okay, so in Japan, this is my sister-in-law told me this, and I've hung on it because I'm like, this is some cold-blooded shit. In Japan, like a cultural custom is giving Christmas cakes to people. I guess kind of like the king cakes that we give out around, Fat Tuesday, around here in the U.S. Anyway, and so there's a saying for like women who are like 26 and unmarried, nobody likes a Christmas cake after Christmas. And I'm like, that's some cold-blooded shit. If your grandparents said that to you, holy shit. So the doctor is not as cold as that, but that's still most of its time, like bringing in this idea of like, well, the most important thing is that you should be with someone. And that's not what the episode's about. The episode is
also
about a young woman who's
like
horny.
A Christmas cake after Christmas sounds like the perfect time to eat it. Gonna eat it all night on Christmas? Are you crazy? So I have a couple more. So I put predicting AI boyfriend or girlfriends.
So like waifus?
And then also the doctor thinking he has a shot with the hottest babe on the ship.
I have a fraught relationship with that character because
she's
not
much
real.
Better looking than
Robert Picardo is fantastic, and he's playing the character exactly as he's being asked. And because he's so good, they gave him more to do. But that was a character that for me got way out over his skis. And I'm like, he is way too important. And I think it just boiled down to like, they only had so many people they could trust to give stuff to. And so then you get these situations.
Yeah.
But see, you just pointed out to me one of my other most of its time episodes. This episode is more about the doctor than it's about Seven of Nine, which is a really big missed opportunity because in that focus on the My Fair Lady of it all, it misses two things. The depth of why. Why is the doctor invested in this? Why does he fall in love with why is there an examine? Why does he care about falling in love? Like, why is that a thing? It would probably be in the same realm of like he could have that understanding for why Seven of Nine. But I think that's is all like born of the idea of why this episode is great for its time and weird now. It's not like it ages badly, but it's kind of like, Seven of Nine is clearly horny. That's what the episode that's
like,
the inspiration.
Yeah, she's clearly like she's curious as to, what goes on.
Yeah.
And like, I don't even think she needs the dating part.
Right. So then this is like their, middle-aged men's way of being like, well, let's play. Like, she's treated like a doll. That's the other part of it, which is very, I don't like that anymore. I've watched so many like art house movies and all that stuff where, you have these beautiful women characters and the camera's just lingering on them. And there's just like this feeling of like it's a doll in a dollhouse that the men get to control and pose and not like control where like they can't do anything. Yeah, but that's what that story is actually about that. But and there's probably too many stories at some point that is about that as like a way of saying acknowledging that they're doing that as a way of skirting how it's kind of like not cool to do that. But anyway, the point here is like it's weird that a story about Seven of Nine. Like it's the impetus is like she wants to have this human connection gets hijacked by this thing that is not real. And it's about the doctor's journey in a way. I thought that was just very strange. Mm-hmm. I'm sure UPN would have loved a hornier episode of Star Trek, to be perfectly honest. But I don't think that that's where they wanted to go.
No.
Scott Thompson. Most of its time.
Yeah.
Also, his boss, the Abbott. Ian Abercrombie, another that guy who we've seen like Brian McNamara, but he was Mr. Pitt on Seinfeld, one of Elaine's bosses at some point. But also, so again, very, very 90s there. In the doctor's PowerPoint presentation, when he talks about the sperm, ovum being besieged by the sperm, that is a footage from the movie, a clip from the movie Look Who's Talking, which came out in 1989. So that's not like of 1999, but using a 10-year-old clip, Look Who's Talking in 1999, people would have remembered. And I remembered it when I saw it, but I'm pretty sure it would take me a very long time to recall that movie if I were to just sit and think about movies. And then I think the doctor's presentation is great, but I'm saying it's a PowerPoint, so that's of its time. If they did it today, it would be like a TED Talk.
Yeah.
So that's the only slight difference there. Any other most of his time?
No.
Now it's time for the line must be drawn here. Great lines. B'Elanna, how the hell do you know when we're having intimate relations? There is no one on Deck 9, Section 12 who doesn't know when you're having intimate relations. I want all the data you've collected. I haven't completed the study. Then study this. Borg provokes Klingon. Klingon breaks Borg nose. Call sick bay. Tell them there's about to be a medical emergency.
Yeah, it's great. I put, this crew can be very efficient at disseminating information when they choose to be. Number one, just saying, you know, saying what we're all thinking, this crew's not that great.
But she is so upset.
Yeah.
She is so upset when she says when they choose to be.
Yeah. They've weaponized incompetence, yeah. I think.
Also, I almost put the doctor's line. Well, they say gossip travels faster than warp speed, but I got really upset because I'm like, no, that ruins the integrity of the reference.
Yeah.
The reference is much better. What is it? Lies travel farther than the truth or faster than the truth?
I don't even know.
That's the quote that it's based on. And that's much more profound than that one. So I don't know. Anyway, but yes, seven, that's a great one. Janeway's after I like that. Apparently this scene was cut in reruns and syndication, but the scene before Janeway's in the transporter room where she's like kind of admonishing Seven. It's not a great scene because it's like too brief and it's not really about anything, but it does have Janeway saying to her, this is a starship, not a nature preserve. So it's a Star Trek construction, almost should be a Trek trope where they say I'm a this, not a that.
I also have our small talk has terminated.
That's a great line to use in your real life. Another one, the doctor asking her, what do you want out of life? Perfection. Seven, I've narrowed the list down to two crewmen based on work performance and compatible interests. I didn't know you had any interests, says Ensign Kim. Seven, neither did I, but apparently they include astronomy, quantum mechanics, and music. Kim, I play the clarinet, you know. Seven, you're not one of the candidates. So cold-blooded. Toman, Scott Thompson, three great lines. An obvious joke that nonetheless said in Scott Thompson's mouth is great. Oh, Seven of mine. But my throat feels like an ancient parchment. And then when they go in, he's got the hangover and they go into the transporter room and the doors whoosh behind him. Those doors are so loud. Any other great lines?
No.
Okay. The Anton Caridian Award for Best Performance.
Well, I think I'm going to give it to Jeri Ryan for this one.
I was leaning Robert Picardo. Oh. I feel like the doctor gets leeway because he's not a real person, that he can be as theatrical as the doctor is most of the time. But you know what? This is kind of like Patrick Stewart. When I send out notes to potential guests, and I'm always like, you know, it's kind of the easy thing to do to pick Patrick Stewart anytime Patrick Stewart's in an episode.
Yeah.
I kind of feel like either Kate Mulgrew or Jeri Ryan, it's kind of the same way. Because there's Jeri Ryan never takes a scene off.
I don't think our first Voyager episode with Jeri Ryan, I think, that we're doing.
That you and I are doing?
Yeah,
I think you're right. I think you're right. Yeah.
So if you've done it a lot before, then I apologize.
No, we'll stay with Jeri Ryan. And I will honorable mention Robert Picardo because, yeah, I agree that I get what people who find it heartbreaking, the ending. And I think that's all because of the performance, that we care at all, you know, that like it actually matters for those people in the audience, like myself and Kristen, who don't care about the holodecks or holograms feelings. But I also want to give a soft honorable mention to Ethan Phillips as Neelix. I don't get to say it very often. Okay. I know I won't. I don't All get right. to say it very often. Hey. I won't get to say it very often. But that is such a straightforward storyline. You know what I mean? Like, he has that one note to play. And he's not obnoxious. He plays off Scott Thompson well. he's like, the direction is just enough. The editing's just enough. They never gets annoying. Like, he's completely believable as being like, I don't know what to do, you know? Right. So he doesn't go too far, but like I said, he really only has those two moods. I know I'm not going to be able to highlight or reference a good Neelix performance very often. So I want to at least mention it here. The Shatner then.
I mean this in the most complimentary way, Scott Thompson.
Of course.
It is, again, not a bad thing to get the Shatner. Not necessarily. Sometimes it is.
Yeah.
Let's be real.
They're both Canadians, though. It would be almost offensive to not give it to the Canadian in this case. So, I mean, a bravura Shatner performance by Scott Thompson there. What part of this will they teach at Starfleet Academy?
The Cadi cannot metabolize alcohol.
Yeah, that, and I would say maybe the protocols or the general guidelines for being a ship-bound ambassador. I'm sure that's like a part of, there are ships that carry, there's like mobile ambassadors of the Federation or something. And, you know, Neelix is basically the ragtag version of this. And I'm sure when Voyager, if he had gone back with him to the Alpha Quadrant, you could have done the My Fair Lady about him joining the diplomatic corps. That might have been cute. But like, you know, I'm sure that Captain Janeway had something to go on when she was like, you should be our ambassador. Here's kind of what you have to do. Anyway, could this episode have been hornier and would that have made it better?
I mean, obviously, on both fronts.
It could have been hornier in that you could have just had a little more leering. Now they get to it with Tommen and all that. I think it was smart to not make him an asshole towards Seven of Nine. It's there. We got the alcohol feeding into it, but he's not like degrading her. He's not pursuing her. You know, he's not being like Pepe Le Pew or anything like that towards her. That's fine. But like Tom Paris makes the point, Tom Paris is a pig, but he's right. He's like half the men on the ship. I should have mentioned this as best Trek trope, acknowledging that all men are not, you know, het. Cis guys who, or just might be attracted to 7 to 9, whatever. I think that was a good line, but like he says it, but we don't see it. You know what I mean? Like, and so I think there's a version, I'm not saying it should have gone this direction, but like where 7 of 9 could have also learned like, oh, you know, people are mainly interested in me for how I look. Perfection is more than just appearance. You know what I mean? Like, and if she's after perfection, then she's going to want someone like that could be a way for her to have learned, like, it is important for people to like me for who I am rather than just how I look. But they didn't want to go that way anyway. And she could have just been hornier. That's the other way. Like that. Maybe that's me being a little too parochial and patriarchal of like, no, let the woman have a little more agency. She could have wanted something. Once the doctor gave her this lesson plan and started guiding her, she could have had her own ideas and she gets none of them. It's like, doesn't happen at all. It's very strange. Anyway, it's just like also realizing what you've got and then not going all in with it. Like Jerry Ryan can play everything and she doesn't, there's other episodes later on where Seven gets drunk, you know, and she does other things. Like, so we do eventually get to see other sides of Seven, but, and a fun episode about being horny, we probably could have used a little more horniness.
Yeah.
All right, so Trek, marry, or kill someone to watch over me.
I liked it. I was going to give it a Trek.
Okay, when I did that troll tweet years ago where I said there are only 20 good episodes of Star Trek Voyager, this episode was one of them.
Okay.
And then before we get the whole Discovery era of shows in 2016 for the 50th anniversary of Star Trek, The Hollywood Reporter ranked the 100 greatest Star Trek episodes of all time, and this was one of them. My feelings about the episode, I have different thoughts, deeper thoughts. I kind of think this is a Mary, though. Like,
oh, wow.
I mean, if I were to tell people to watch Star Trek Voyager, this would be one of the episodes I would recommend. I think even though it misses some interesting possibilities with Seven, Jerry Ryan's so good in it. The Doctor's good in it. The B storyline both matters and is great. How often do we get to say that about a lot of Star Trek episodes where the B plot is interesting or fun? So I don't know. I kind of think as a episode of Star Trek, you know, I think it earns the Mary. So if you don't want to join me on that, that's fine. We'll put it to vote.
Sure. I can be convinced.
again, it's a not a science fiction explosion episode. It's a science fiction character episode, and I appreciate the effort. I think they nailed it as best they could at the time it was made. And I, along those lines, we kind of have also been looking at big swings.
Mm-hmm.
Is this a big swing that connects, Kristen?
Well, not sexually, but sure.
It's a big swing, but it's like it's that's a home run swing, but it winds up being like a dribbler through the infield.
Yeah, it just went through someone's legs.
Yeah, it's like you were expecting maybe a little bit more, but like, hey, you know what? It got the job done. They connected at least a little bit. All right, so there we go. An Mary for Star Trek Voyager. Next week, Spock's Vulcan side is purged by weird aliens just before an important dinner with his mother-in-law. No, this is not an episode of the Dick Van Dyke Show. It's charades from Strange New Worlds.
Spock doesn't try to cook, does he? I'll have to find out. Okay.
Yeah, you'll just have to find out.
Okay. Am I on this one? Am I on?
You're on this one. Yep. So check us out on social media, Trek Mary K-Pod, on the web at Trek Mary Kill. Pod.com. And if you're so inclined, rate and review us 5 stars wherever you listen. Our big swing month will continue with charades. And so until next week, TMK out.
Bye.